So welcome everybody to today's meditation class. And today we do have the introduction to meditation class happening. These are for the people who want to do the shortcut to enlightenment. So that's those who are starting off their meditation practice. And that's being taken by Prem. I think that's in the room next door, isn't it? Yeah, okay, that makes it nice and easy. So anybody who is a bit afraid of meditating for 2 hours without moving, that's a nice place to go. I didn't say you were going to meditate for 2 hours without moving, if you're afraid of that. No, sometimes when you meditate, you get into some really nice peaceful states of meditation. You don't want to come out of meditation. And that's very beautiful when that happens. That's why it hasn't happened so much this last year. But I remember sometimes earlier, been meditating here and at 4 o'clock, when I usually ring the gong, sometimes there's one or two people just carry on meditating. And if you want to, that's fine, just stay here. And then usually we lock up in the evening, and then when we open the doors in the morning, then we can let you out. It's perfectly safe. No, that's just can you hear what I'm saying in there, Brim? Okay. Very good. Okay. So Prem is a teacher over there. What's he doing? Let's get some cushions. Oh, cushions. Okay, great. So that's for those people who are just doing the... he's also the chairman of our meditation group. That's why he holds the chairs. You're slow, come on. So anyway, we can actually start being a little bit more serious. Because one of the things, the questions people often ask me about in meditation is that just when a person is meditating, some people think they can't stop thinking. They don't know what silence is. Present moment awareness, maybe sometimes, but silence. How can you have some silence? Because it's not that they are not silent. It's because they don't recognize what silence is. And to explain what I mean, is when you come into this room here, what do you notice when you first come in here? Now, you notice the carpet, you notice the seats, you notice the people, the big statue behind me, the fans and the ceiling. But we notice things, we notice objects. And even in this hall, there is much more space than there are things. But because our brain is not trained to notice the space, it's only noticing the things in the room, the objects in the room, the things to avoid, not the space, which is far greater within this building. What it means is we just change our perception slightly. And we see that in this building here, there's much more space than there is things. And we're not afraid of space. You can look at space in two ways. You can say it's what separates us. But also you can say it's what connects us, what it holds us all. And the space is so large, you can accept everybody into it. It never rejects anybody, which is a wonderful idea of compassion and kindness. It's like the space in this room binds us all together and gives us space just to be comfortably. And that is like the silence of the mind. A silence is like a no thought, no idea, no concept. It's a quietness. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's there, but we're not really being trained to notice it. It's one of those reasons, one of those experiences I had as a young man, which, you know, was stayed with me for a long time. This was when I was young, just pre-university, and had time off, so I went first of all to visit United States, which was quite basically boring. It's not much different than the rest of the places I grew up in. But I always liked to go down to Central America. I had a sort of kind of affinity for it because I had jungles there. And one of the places I went to was in Guatemala, in this Yucatan Peninsula. And in there, in these ancient rainforests, there was these civilizations which had been declined and disappeared before even the Spanish conquistadors came in. No one knows exactly why the civilization vanished. It was the Mayan civilization, M-A-Y-A. And they made these big pyramids up in a place called Tikal. And it took days to get there. And that was wonderful that it took me days to get there. These days you just get on an aircraft or something. It's a big tourist attraction. But because it took days on the back of trucks and fishing vessels and stuff to actually reach that place, then when I got there, there was hardly anybody there. In fact, as far as I can remember, there was only just one sort of archaeologist was digging around there, myself and my little tuk-tuk driver. That's the Thai word, tuk-tuk, but you know what I mean, just motorcycle, taxi. And those are the only people who were there. And I was really enjoying myself because I could wander around anywhere. There was no guides, there's no fences. Wherever you wanted to go, you just could go. And so one of the things I wanted to do was actually climb one of those pyramids. These days, they say, why do you do that? It's a long way up. And the only reason why I wanted to climb that was because, as one of those Himalayan mountaineers says, it's because it was there. In other words, no reason at all. It's kind of a boy thing. That, you know, you saw a big pyramid, let's see if you can get to the top of it, see what's on top. And I'm glad I did that, because when I got to the top, I kind of had an understanding about what those great monuments were there for. At least, you know, as I expected, as I sort of had the insight at the time. And that was, for days you've been in a jungle. And in a jungle you can't see great distances. It's so many vines and trees and bushes. Everything is so dense. But when you get to the top of one of these pyramids, it's just above the tree line. So number one, you have this beautiful air flowing over the jungle canopy. You have winds. So it feels very fresh on top of the pyramid. And number two, you can see long distances. And that really struck me. I'd only been 2 or 3 days in the jungle, but for the first time in those three days, you could see long distances. As I put it at the time, it's like you could see infinity in all directions forever. And there's nothing blocking you and infinity everywhere. The space, the emptiness, was so profound because you'd just come from a closed up thicket of jungle. And that sort of reminds me of just what silence is like. You know, here in Perth we can go to the beach, we can see great distances, you can go to the lookout opposite Bodhinyana Monastery and see great views. Or you can go down to Venerable Muda's Monastery, stand on the cliffside and watch the ocean there. Beautiful views. But if you're living in lots and lots of thoughts, plans, problems to solve, those thoughts and those plans, it's like a forest of thoughts and ideas. And you can't see very far with all those thoughts and ideas. But then what happens is you do like find a pyramid. You do find a way to recognize what life is like, what your mind is like, when it just is perfectly aware but not giving anything a name and no thoughts. It's like a jungle above the jungle. where the air can flow freely, where it's cool, and you can see forever, with nothing between you and the reality in all directions. That is like the silence. That space in a jungle is always there. It's just you've got to go up something, climb something, to get above the jungle, to be able to see that silence, that emptiness. And that's what we do in meditation. There comes a time when all those words and ideas, those thoughts, just fall away. You can see what's between them, what's above them, what's beyond them. This idea of the silence of the mind becomes something which you get used to and which you value. And if you do see that silence, please don't give it a name. Otherwise, you're destroying it. That's one of the reasons I kind of find it sad that in ancient days we had mountains, and then what people did when they got to the top of the mountain, they put a flag on top of it. They didn't kind of conquer it, they tried to own it. These days we don't put flags on top of mountains anymore. We put mobile phone towers, which is even worse. But it's wonderful to recognize silence. It's one of the reasons why, if you love nature, you go to some remote places. You don't want to stack up any stones. You don't want to leave any mark that you were there. Ajahn Brahm was here. You don't do stuff like that. That's actually almost desecrating the silence, the emptiness of those places in our world, or those places in our mind. So after a while, you find that everyone, even people who think so much, have many moments of silence. It's not as if you have to create that silence. You just need to learn how to notice it. It's there. I don't need to create the space in this hall. It's already here. Just ask people to notice it. You don't need to help point out that above every jungle, jungle of trees or jungle of ideas or concrete jungle, above that is this wonderful space. And once that's pointed out, something happens. Is you value and see the beauty, like the purity in space, in emptiness, in what's between things rather than things themselves. You learn how to perceive things in a different way. You don't perceive how many people are in the room, you perceive how much space there is in this room. You don't perceive all the ideas and thoughts in your head, you can perceive the space, the gaps between those thoughts. You can hear the sound of the fans in the, on the ceiling. But instead of trying to figure out a word for it, there's so much in this world we just don't have words for. Wonderful. Don't invent a word for it. You can know what a thing is very accurately without being able to find a word to convey that meaning to somebody else. If they want to know what you're talking about, say, listen. You don't need to try and describe it in words and in thoughts and try and capture it. Because you always find that, I don't know if ever you've had to write an article for somebody about something. Being a monk, you always get caught writing an article, your opinion about this or whatever. Sometimes they don't like doing that. Because whatever you write about, it's never accurate. Even just, you know, what silence actually is, to describe it. You can't. You can get close to it, but that's all you can do, get close, and you miss so much. That's why poets, anyone who is a great poet, They don't do this on every poem they write, but every now and again they can write a couple of stanzas. And they could really see deeply into something and convey that understanding, or some of that understanding, in words. That's why poets sometimes have this almost miracle, being able to capture something which so many people can't capture in words and convey it to others. But you don't need to have a poet, you don't need to be a poet. You just need to know the silence of the mind. It's there. It's one of the reasons why you know that one of those examples which I've, or little example, teaching examples which I've given many, many times. I remember doing this to a class over in Singapore of executives and just asking them, please listen to me as I'm talking. And as I was talking, I would pause. When I pause, some people thought, has he had a stroke? Is there something wrong with him? He's not had a stroke. In those pauses, you did not know when I was going to start speaking again. Out of respect, you waited. Waiting in this moment, not waiting in the future for something to happen, but waiting in this moment. You experience silence. It's like it's always there. And once we notice it, you turn to that in meditation, and your meditation takes off. It becomes more and more beautiful, more and more delightful. And the delight, the pleasure which comes with silence is something which is remarkable. It gives you so much happiness and joy. But that's for you to find out. This is just the introduction. And the importance, and every one of you, I'm sure you can know that silence really easily. Okay, so let's get going. I will now be silent too. I'm going to give the introduction. I hope you don't mind the guided meditation at the beginning. Sometimes I wonder, should I be doing it? Because I like just being silent, but I do get enough time for myself to be quiet and meditate. So this is just a little gift to you, a little bit of guidance at the beginning, and then when I'm quiet, you're on your own, in silence. And it's useful to, again, make sure your body is nice and comfortable. That's one of the reasons why I start doing the talking. There's a couple of reasons why I do the guidance to begin with. One is to encourage you to grow in this mindfulness and kindness. These two factors which are really important. Build those two up together, the kindfulness, when it gets really strong, then you don't need any guidance. The mind will know what to do. But it's also the case that because I'm speaking, that I'm taking over this inner dialogue or inner monologue which you have with yourself. So you're listening to me talk rather than trying to think of something to think about yourself. Which means after a few minutes, it kind of shuts down those inner thoughts which you have. So those are some of the reasons why we do this. So anyway, let's get starting. And also it gets the wonderful awareness of your body, which is really helpful for your physical health and well-being. You know how you feel. You get to know your bodily parts. Some of you have been living with your lungs, with your heart, with your legs, with your, I don't know what else you have, but you've been living with these things for so many years, but do you really understand them yet? Remember this little doctor saying, no one ever gets a big heart attack or a stroke just off the cuff. Your body gives you many warnings, first of all. But a lot of times we're not aware enough to notice those warnings. When you develop mindfulness and kindness to your body, you get to feel those warnings. And you can take positive action on how to keep this body healthy and strong. You're aware of your body and you have the kindness to know how to respond appropriately if you can. So I'm just being aware of my body as well as talking with you. Especially aware of my legs to begin with. This is where I build up the awareness and the kindness. Just making sure my legs are comfortable. And they are not. My cushion is not in its proper place. I'm going to just adjust the cushion on which I'm sitting. So I had a good fidget. It's much nicer now. And just when you're kind to somebody, you know, you ask someone how they are, how they're traveling, and give them kindness, it's amazing just how a gesture of kindness, even a smile and a hello, that makes a lot of difference to people. And it seems that my body responds in the same way. When I ask my legs, how are you? Is there anything you need? Like so many times people ask me if I want a cup of tea or a drink of water or something. I may not need a cup of tea or water or whatever, but thank you for asking. That's like my legs. Are you okay down there, legs? Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking. And my legs respond by relaxing. And when they relax, the feelings which I can experience down in my legs are much more gentle. They're softer. You don't get the hard jabbing pains or aches. Or things which you have to endure. Instead, when things relax, it doesn't give any work to my mind. My mind can be at peace. It's just like making sure your car is well locked and well parked. When you come in here, you know it's going to be safe when you go back to it afterwards. And my body, when I set up my body correctly, when the meditation is over, I know my body is going to be in a good shape. So I don't have to be concerned with it, no business to be done with my body once it's set up properly. So I ask my legs and my butt and my back. My back appreciated that bit of attention because it just wanted to stretch. If I'm not aware of it, I just don't know, so I check, make sure. My back feels good. And I just go up this inside of my body, which is always interesting. It's been a long time since I studied anatomy. Got a rough idea of what's where. But probably, if I'm just scanning my liver, I'm probably scanning kidneys instead, I'm not quite sure. But anyway, something there, you can feel it. Relax it. Wish it well. I care for you, liver. And that makes everything just become so at ease. Lungs. All these respiratory diseases which are around these days. Poor lungs are very vulnerable. Thank you, lungs, for keeping yourself healthy. My whole body, my torso, big engine room of my life. I give it gratitude. Thank you for looking after me so pretty well for almost 72 years. And I can't forget anything, shoulders and arms. Checking everything. Shoulders a bit tight. Oh yeah. The way the monk's robes are, they can sometimes dig into your shoulder muscles. Just adjusting that. I'm getting my fingers just in the right place. And all the time, the only way I know how my fingers are is to be able to feel them. But I notice that that experience of feeling the well-being of my fingers is in silence. I don't have the words to describe them. You just know them. You know how they feel. And you trust them. And they reply, they feel great. I'm getting to understand just how a silent awareness of something is much more accurate than ideas and thoughts and explaining things in words. And go to the head, making sure that's nicely relaxed. Once my body is relaxed, I can let it go. It's like parking it in the appropriate car bay. I know it's going to be there afterwards. So so I can let it go. And I come to the present moment. The last time I was here, a couple of weeks ago, if you are a little bit busy, you can do that little exercise, imagining you've got two bags, one in each hand. They're very heavy. You've been carrying them for a long time. The one on the left hand has got a words written on the outside. It's not like Woolworths or Coles or anything. On the outside it's written PAST, past. In that bag you keep all of your memories, important ones and just trivial ones. And they're very heavy. I've been carrying them a long time. I'm not going to ask you to get rid of them. Just to put them down for a few minutes. You can imagine just lowering that bag to the ground. It carries all your past memories. When it meets the ground, there's no more weight, no burden, allowing you to move your hands away from the handle and feel your arm just to rest by your side. You haven't abandoned the past, you just put it down for a while to relax so you don't have to be concerned about it. It's safe. And then the same with your right hand bag. It's got FUTURE written on the outside. That's where you put all your fears, all your business, things to be done, hopes and dreams. You imagine lowering that to the ground. When that meets the ground, the weight of the future disappears. It's borne by the floor now. And that allows you also to move your hand away, your right hand away from that bag. It's safely by your side on the ground. Allows your right hand and arm and shoulder to recuperate. And in this imaginary exercise, you look down, see those two bags, which we carry way too long. We even carry them in our sleep, so we never sleep well. You put them down, and you, there you are, standing in between them. This amazing place called the present moment. You make sure you don't pick up anything from those bags until the meditation is finished. It's safe. And you feel free. You can rest. Your poor brain can get a break. And when you're in the present moment, it may be easier to notice the silence in your mind. Perfectly aware of what's happening now, but don't try and describe it. Don't take notes of what's happening. If it really is important, your memory will know what it is afterwards. In the meantime, just let it be in silence. And any instructions such as, what am I supposed to do next? Where am I supposed to be going? Leave all that aside. Shh. Don't interrupt the process of meditation. If you do feel sleepy because you're tired, just know what sleepiness feels like. It's not against any precept, it's not immoral to be sleepy. Just let it be and it will just disappear by itself. Your job is just to be peaceful, be silent. And to know by feeling these states of mind, not by trying to imprison them in words. I will now be quiet. When I start speaking again, it will probably be a couple of minutes before the end of the meditation. getting close to the end of the meditation period now. No need to try and put it into words, but how do you feel inside? How much peace and stillness can you recognize? Can you notice its emotive quality? Sense of joy, kindness, softness. A sense of freedom. No one is telling you what to do. Not even you. And how does your body feel? This vehicle which you now come back to. In a moment I will ring the gong. After the first, third ringing of the gong, it's a signal to open your eyes. End the meditation. Okay, let's see if there's any questions from overseas. It is helpful to be able to share these teachings with other places in the world, especially that you know, you go overseas and you find so many cities and places that would love to have some meditation, but it's just too remote. Anyway, dear Ajahn, I tend to tilt left to right and right to left after a while in meditation, like upside down pendulum. That's fine. Just, if that's what the body wants to do, let it do it. There was a very well known Thai monk years ago, Aslung Pu Wen. He became famous when he was spotted by a fighter pilot sitting on a cloud, an Air Force pilot in Thailand. And of course it really shocked the pilot, he took the coordinates and later on, when he had some leave, went down to try and find this monk and found him. He became famous after that, but Aslung Pu Wen would always sit with his head tilted in one direction. He was enlightened. So maybe you tend to tilt left to right and right to left. Maybe that's where you're headed. In other words, just let the body do what it needs to do. I wouldn't bother with the body. Just, you know, as long as it's reasonably comfortable, then let it be. And after a while, just let the body disappear. If you really go tilting a lot, then just maybe just, if you're sitting on a chair, wear a seat belt. You don't fall off. You're not going to fall off anyway, so I wouldn't worry about it. There was, I don't know whether Saurav, that must be the person, from Minnesota. How can I influence my daughter to make the right decisions? She is. It's not a joke, they're being serious. She is a teenager, now why would she go down the wrong path? Just be kind to her, just show her kindness and give her some space, because it's really tough being a teenager. You've got so many competing interests, and I'm sure that she loves her mum, but, whoops, sure she loves her mum, but even if she does go down a wrong path, you learn a lot by going down a wrong path. Just make sure it's not too far wrong. I was telling, you know, some of the monks some of the things which I used to get up to as a young teenager. And it was a wrong path. But everyone else was doing the same, and I didn't have enough wisdom to know exactly what I was doing. And to let you know, this is not what I would recommend you follow. But even when I was at university, there was a really good university at Cambridge in England. And I was even smart at the university, so I was one of the scholars there. So I was about the top 10% or something. And so that every year they had a scholars' dinner. And that scholars' dinner was, people said, oh, you're so lucky to be able to go to the scholars' dinner. A 9-course meal preceded by sherry in the old library, the gallery. And that was designed by Sir Christopher Wren. This was really very posh. Served by butlers, I mean real butlers, English butlers in tails. And I was studying maths at the time, and I worked out with my friend that if we go around the table, that the waiters were going, or the butlers were going around in a clockwise direction. If we went into an anti-clockwise direction, we would meet the butler twice per circuit, thereby getting twice as much sherry as everybody else. That was how you thought in those days. And then a different wine with every course, the 9-course meal. And that was finished with going into the old library. And that was when they had 3 glasses, one for port, one for Madeira, and one for sherry. Yeah, port, Madeira, and sherry. Anyway. And then, they were always kept full, except when you drank them. And then the goblet came around. This silver enjeweled heirloom of a Cambridge college, about this big. Had to fill it to the top with port, then drain it, drink it all down, and then say a toast in Latin. Which was very hard to do. I don't know if you know Latin. We've had so much wine, it's almost impossible to do, and I don't remember much about what happened then. And that was supposed to be a good thing to do. And afterwards, I thought, it was crazy. And what happened, I think you may know the story. I woke up, I got back to my room somehow, but when I woke up, I had a big pile of vomit on my pillow, right next to my head. It's disgusting. I never realized how actually dangerous that was. It's very easy to die that way. Choke on your own vomit. But it was just so disgusting. I felt so embarrassed about myself. And this was supposed to be some of the most intelligent men in UK. Didn't say very much for intelligence. I know one of the people was a Nobel laureate, but that was a terrible thing to do. But even though I made a mistake, in my young life, I still learned so much from it. You did go around the wrong path, but you actually could challenge it and say, no, that's not the right thing to do. And that was honestly, believe it or not, that was the last alcohol I ever drank in my life. I I just went to an extreme and that was it, no more. It didn't make any sense. So how to influence your daughter? Just trust your daughter. Trust her and just give her lots of kindness and love. In life, that's what teenagers are there for, to make mistakes. When they make mistakes, learn from them, that's all. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you share meditation techniques to develop Brahma Viharas? Brahma Viharas are these qualities of metta, that's something like loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and instead of equanimity, contentment. And of course, you know, you can't do that sort of in brief. We used to do this chanting in Bodhinyana Monastery when I first went there, of developing the four Brahma Viharas, and I had to ask, you know, Ajahn Chakra, who was the abbot then, can I, we stop these, please? Because I just, what was happening to me, it's chanting Pali. I understood exactly what it all meant. And when they were chanting, it inspired me so much, I just couldn't do any more chanting. It just was actually spreading the loving kindness. And you got sort of blissed out. So it's not the right occasion here, but I'm sure you can find those instructions in many other places. From Sumbak, how do I stop my overthinking in regards to other people? Thank you. You don't know other people. It's hard enough to know yourself. And can you really judge yourself? Can you really understand yourself that well? And this is one of our problems, that we assume we can understand what other people are doing, why they're doing it. Just a simple example, that last night when I told that story, which I've said many times before, about that retreat where a person had sinus cancer, and they got so upset at him because he was breathing loudly. We never explained that. It was not because he was doing this on purpose. He had a big tumor in his sinuses, couldn't breathe through his nose. And as soon as people understood, they weren't critical anymore. This is one of the reasons why, when it regards other people, sometimes we just get it all wrong. We don't know why they do things, or what they're doing, or why they're doing things. It's much better just to leave them alone. It's hard enough to judge yourself. In fact, you can't really judge yourself. So how on earth can you judge other people? So instead of overthinking other people, just be over-kind to other people. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Give them kindness. Give them compassion. Give them this wonderful space. I don't know why you said that, but yeah, one reason, there must be something there why you do these things. Toronto, how can I reduce the strength of my carnal desires without becoming obsessive about it? I'm overweight and have a snacking addiction. I'm overweight, but I don't have a snacking addiction. Honest. Do I have a snacking addiction? No. You can't eat in the afternoon. Sorry?
Eat what you're given.
You eat what you're given, yeah. And in the afternoon, evening, there's nothing you can eat. Okay, yeah, you can have some cheese sometimes, but not in Bodhinyana Monastery, in here in Jhana Grove. But a lot of time you don't have any of it anyway. And there's nothing to snack on. So anyway, a snacking addiction, but what it really is because the happiness of peace is not there. If you can find some peaceful happiness, in other words, when you are meditating, you find that so satisfying. That's one of the reasons why last week I wasn't here, because I was in my cave in Bodhinyana Monastery meditating. I was tired when I came back from overseas and had 10 days of retreat, just personal retreat. Relaxing, resting, meditating. That's all you needed. Didn't have anything to snack on. There's no chocolate, there's no cheese, there's no other little things which you can sometimes like. All you just have is a cup of tea. Couldn't call that a snack, not even sugar. So, how you do that? Because you were happy meditating. So, how can you reduce the strength of carnal desires without becoming obsessive about it? Find peace inside. Meditate. And then The peace or happiness of meditation far exceeds any delight you get from any carnal desires. Again, that's what happened to me. Even as a student, I had girlfriends, only one at a time. But sometimes that last girlfriend I had, sometimes I feel sorry, should apologize to her. Went on a 9-day retreat, got some really nice meditation, and that was it with regard to relationships. The meditation was more beautiful, much more delightful. That was the end of relationships. Ajahn, please explain how a thought is created. To understand that helps to feel lighter. Like I sometimes compare thoughts, just a way of looking at them, like the waves on the surface of a pond. And if the pond is really still, there's no waves on it at all, that's where it looks most beautiful. You can see what's inside the pond of water. It perfectly reflects the moon and the stars in the heavens above. But why are there waves? Like thoughts, the disturbance there. All thoughts are disturbances of the mind. They're actually unnecessary. We think they're necessary. We think a lot, we'd be able to solve lots of problems. If you think a lot, you make more problems. Every now and again a thought is okay, but not too many. Of all the thoughts you've had even today, what percentage have been useful? It's not that high percentage, is it? So that's how a thought is created. And sometimes it's all we know. We know how to think. We've been encouraged to think. But we haven't been encouraged to see, to feel, to hear, to know without the thinking. It's amazing just how many ideas people have. How big are the libraries in our world? How many books are written? That's one of the reasons why I was a bit reticent to write books. And that's one of the reasons why the Zen monk warned me when I was still a young man. Anyone who writes a book on Buddhism, it was a warning. Anyone who writes a book on Buddhism will have to spend the next 7 lifetimes reborn as a donkey. I've got many lives as a donkey to get. Yeah. Anyway, that's how thoughts are created. What is the right meditation to practice to relieve anxiety? Just present moment awareness is great. I've been doing guided meditation, but I'm sure it's the same method as meditation. It's good enough. As long as you feel peace, and you feel some silence inside. In the present moment, remember anxiety is all about the future. What's the future going to be? I haven't got a clue. Sometimes people ask me to predict the future. You've been a monk for such a long time, you must have some good meditation. What's the future going to be? Especially the new year, do you want to know? I follow my teacher Ajahn Chah because he was pressed by one of his students, who said, I know you can do this. Can you read the lines on the palm of my hand to tell me my future, my destiny? And Ajahn Chah said, no, good monks don't do that. He said, but I know you can. Even if I could, why would I do that? I've looked after you, I've been kind to you, said this man. I've fed you, given you donations. Why can't you do this one thing for me out of gratitude? Read the lines on the palm of my hand. So Ajahn Chah said, okay, I will do it for you. It's the first and only time Ajahn Chah read the palms on somebody's hand. And so he did it very slowly. And every now and again he would stop. Don't know about that. Oh, that's interesting. And this poor fellow was being wound up terribly. And when he finished, the man couldn't wait. What's my future going to be? And Ajahn Chah said, well, look, I cannot lie. What I'll tell you will actually happen. Yeah, I know. What's going to happen? And he said, sir, your future is uncertain. And Ajahn Chah was right. So if you want to have your future told by any of the monks or nuns, that's what's going to happen. It's uncertain, sorry. And that means you can relieve anxiety. You don't know what's going to happen. When you don't know what's going to happen, you can't say the worst is going to happen or the best is going to happen. You don't know. It'd be something different. From Gloria, halfway through the meditation, I started doing metta. When I think, may I be free from guilt, I start to break down crying. And the guilt from early childhood is so strong that I'm not able to hold it at all. How to deal with the intense guilt arising? I don't know what you did as a child. Children are usually sort of, you know, haven't got really bad intentions, they're not evil. They're just kids messing around, doing silly things. But first of all, what I would actually ask you to say, are you really that child? If you saw little my lay name was Peter Betts, is there like a book somewhere you can actually see photos of me as a little baby and as a silly kid having his photograph taken? How many of you would really think that was me if I didn't actually point it out to you? You look totally different character. Even if I got any one of you and found out what you look like, sort of, how old are you now? Who is it? Who's the oldest person here now? Even Lucky. How old are you now? 80? How old? 80. You've forgotten. Well, anyway, however old you are, if I could manage to conjure up you as a young girl, maybe 10 or 11 years of age, would anybody be able to recognize that you're the same person? We'd actually change. It's an easy way to let go of the guilt of the past. It's actually just you didn't really know what you were doing as a child. You know, you were just learning. So there's a wonderful, easy sense of being able to forgive a person when they're young. They don't know really what they're up to. We're learning about life. So you'd no need to be critical of you. So just best thing not to judge. It's like a different person when you're that young. Dear Ajahn, I have a partner outside of becoming a monk. Eh? I have a partner. Oh, hence outside of becoming a monk. Do you have any advice on how can I expedite my path to enlightenment? I meditate 2 hours daily and quitting my job to pursue this path. It's wonderful you're doing that, but if you do have a partner, sometimes what people do is that they have this kind of celibate relationship, like with good friends. Mahakasapa had a partner, and he became a monk, she became a bhikkhuni, and they actually, obviously they were friends together, but they never actually had any sexual relations. So you have a partner, but it becomes more like a Socratic relationship. In other words, you just you're friends together, you understand, you talk together, but that's the attachment there is just not there anymore. How can I trust men when my father left me when I was a child? I'm a man. Do you trust me? Hopefully you do. In other words, not all men are the same. Not all women are the same. You may have a bad experience with one, but then again, if your father left you when you were a child, you don't really know why he thought that was the best thing to do. No one can ever judge anybody in my book. So there's many very wonderful men around. Don't just judge everybody and make an image of that man, a friend, a partner in life, and just put your father's face on that man. In other words, just don't judge all men just by one person. Okay. Anyway, those are the questions online here. Any questions from the audience here? Going. Going. Gone. Okay. So now we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can go and do what we need to do for later on this afternoon. Very good.